Well, it has been a few weeks since we've been in here on a Wednesday night studying through the Old Testament together, so I should probably remind you where we are, huh? We're in the book of Exodus. Hopefully you remembered at least that much. More specifically, we're at chapter 28 of the book of Exodus. Moses is still up there on the mountaintop receiving instruction from the Lord. And that's where he will be until chapter 32, where the Lord abruptly sends Moses down the mountain to deal with a national disaster, not a natural disaster, a national disaster. The people were down there already breaking the commandments. But until then, it's all instruction and note-taking for Moses. At this point, the Lord has given much instruction about the building of the tabernacle and many of the pieces of furniture inside of the tabernacle. And though the Lord is not done with that yet, though he still has to give instructions for the altar of incense and the brazen, the bronze basin or the bronze laver and a few other odds and ends, what he's going to do is take a two-chapter break right here in order to instruct Moses, to direct Moses in the role of Aaron and Aaron's sons in the priestly ministry. Up until this point, it didn't exist. There was no priesthood. It hadn't been set up yet. The Lord was working toward that, and these two chapters deal with that, Exodus chapter 28 and Exodus chapter 29. They detail out God's plan to establish that priesthood for the nation of Israel. Chapter 28 is all about the garments that the high priests and the priests were to wear when serving the Lord, when ministering to the Lord. Thus, the title of our message and study tonight, Dressed for Duty. If you thought tonight was going to be a seminar or a conference on what you should wear to church services, you're going to leave here without that information. This is all about Old Testament worship and what the priests were to wear, chapter 28. Chapter 29, then, is going to give us detail about the ordination of those priests, the ordination of Aaron and the ordination of Aaron's sons, that official service where they consecrate those priests, where they dedicate them to the service of the Lord. We have got a lot to cover tonight, so I want to get going with that little bit of an introduction just to set us back into the setting, remind us where we are, refresh us as we take a look at the tabernacle and everything connected to it. So verse 1 of Exodus chapter 28, I read, "Now take Aaron your brother and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister to me as priest. Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar." The word priest in verse 1 is translated from the Hebrew word Kohen, and along the way that became a surname for those Jews that could connect their lineage back to Levi, and of course specifically through Aaron, the son of Levi. So for the most part, when you hear a Jew give you their name today, modern day, and they tell you their last name is Kohen, that's what that is technically telling you, whether it's true or not. It's tough to really know because all of those genealogical records were destroyed in 70 AD. But for those that kept personal record of that well, went on to embrace that name Kohen, that last name Kohen, that connected them to Aaron, thus to Levi, what that would do is if the priesthood were still a valid functioning ministry today, that would authorize them, that would enable them to be priests in that ministry or priests in that priestly service. But of course, the priestly service has come to an end in the New Testament days. Now, that will factor into our study in the book of Revelation as we start to look at that newly built temple there on the Temple Mount in the city of Jerusalem. And the temple is once again going, and we read about the sacrificial system being once again used. And if you study current events, you know there's a bunch of people in Israel with the last name Kohen that have everything they need. They have the garb that we're going to study tonight. They've made the instruments for the temple. They're just waiting for the temple to be built, and they're ready to hop back in there and continue on this priestly line of service. But that's neither here nor there for our study tonight. The most important thing for you to note here is that the priestly ministry was by God's appointment only. It had to be a calling. It is easy to lose sight of that when we consider the fact that from this point forward, everyone who's going to be a priest is going to be born into that lineage, therefore born into that calling. But remember, it's still a calling nonetheless. God selected this lineage, this family line, because once again, as I've shared with you, there's no such thing as nepotism in the Bible. It's not a concept known to God. He doesn't care a thing about nepotism. People today in our world, they get bent out of shape over nepotism. Oh, the pastor and the assistant pastor, they're related. That's terrible, nepotism. Oh, those two working in that ministry, functioning together, they're related. That's nepotism. Well, it may be nepotism. It may be favoritism that's being showed to family members, or it just may be that those are the people that God called for that role. As far as the priestly line was concerned, it all came from that one family, Levi, specifically through the son of Aaron. So you couldn't just wake up one day and think to yourself, you know, I might like to be a priest. Man, they get to dress up fancy. They get to represent the people before God. That's pretty cool. Where do I go to seminary for that? Where do I go to seminary for that? Where do I get my degree or my certificate to make me a priest? Nope, not a thing. Not possible. You had to be born into this calling. But please do remember, it was a calling nonetheless. In the New Testament, things figure a little bit differently because the priesthood, as I mentioned, which was a type that has been fulfilled and disbanded. And as far as the Lord is concerned, every believer now in the New Testament era, in the New Covenant of Grace, every believer is a member of that priesthood. The Apostle Peter told us that in 1 Peter chapter 2, in verse 5, he calls us a holy priesthood. He's talking about church people. He says we're a holy priesthood in verse 9, in verse 5. In verse 9, he calls us a royal priesthood. And it's really an incredible concept to think about, that that Old Testament priesthood had served its purpose. It taught us what the Lord wanted it to teach us. It taught us how to come into the presence of the Lord and work for him and draw near to him. But now that priesthood has served its purpose and we've learned those truths and we've learned those lessons about the Lord, now we understand that under the new covenant, we have the full rights and privileges as priests to come into the holy place, as it were, and minister to the Lord, to serve the Lord, to work for him. It's amazing. You don't have to be born with Levi genes. You don't have to be born from the lineage of Aaron. Whoever you are, when the Lord saves you, you can come right into the holy place. That is the symbol of service for the Lord. The more incredible thing here, and I know we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but the more incredible thing here is that never in the Bible is the human being compared to the high priest. The high priest is a type for only one, and that is Jesus himself. We can't even think to make that claim that we have those rights as a high priest. We understand we have the rights as a priest to come into the holy place and work for the Lord, no matter who we are. But the incredible thing is, though we don't fit the type of the high priest, yet he's taken it a step further and he's given us that right and privilege that only the high priest had, that we can now go into the Holy of Holies, that second compartment in the tabernacle, into the deep presence of God and experience his glory for ourselves. I think that is an incredibly wonderful thing. And if I knew the Lord didn't know better, I would think, Lord, are you sure that's the right move? Are you sure you want us in there? Are you sure we have that right? You're the high priest. Only you, Lord, can fill that role. Only you are holy and righteous and perfect enough to go into the deep presence of God. And yet on the cross, he ripped the veil in two at the time of his death, swung open the doors to welcome us in to the Holy of Holies. Now, as far as the official role of the pastor goes, or the preacher, or the Bible teacher, or ministry worker, or evangelist, or missionary, as far as those official titles go, I don't think anything has changed as far as the calling is concerned. Now, that original calling through the family line, the Lord did away with that. There's no longer Jew or Gentile, male or female, bond or free. None of that matters to the Lord. You're saved. You can do this. You can be a part of this. You can experience that. But I do think for the official role, for all of those official roles, in fact, that the Lord still operates by calling. Wouldn't you agree? We can all do the work. You can do the work of a pastor right now if you're a mom or a dad. You can go home and shepherd your flock and anyone else that will give you that place of voice and influence in their lives. You can do that ministry because the Lord has brought you in. He's given you the rights and privileges. He'll equip you. He'll empower you. But as far as that official role goes, priest, pastor, teacher, preacher, whatever it might be, it has to be only from a calling from the Lord. And the reason for that is, of course, don't miss the obvious, he's the head of the church. And he pieces the church together the way that he wants to. So he calls the pastors that he wants to. We can't just all come up here and be pastor. Although sometimes I wouldn't mind, you know, being spelled for a while so I could get some rest and recover. But no, we can't all just rush up here and be an official pastor or an official preacher or teacher or ministry worker or evangelist. Those are roles that we leave to the Lord, those official titles. We let that up to the calling of God because he is the head of the church and he pieces the church together as he wills, each piece called by God and fitting in its proper place. And I think that's important because if you try to do the work in those official capacities without the calling, I can almost predict what's going to happen. At some point, you're gonna force yourself into early retirement. You're going to call it quits. I tell you that because the calling is everything when it comes to ministry longevity of any sort. If you're going to stick in the ministry, it's probably going to be because of the calling. If you don't have the calling, the day is going to come and things are going to get tough and you're going to look around the Christian crowd and you're going to say, man, I shouldn't be doing this. There's other people that are better than me, and they should step forward. I should resign. And hey, I don't have a calling after all. There are many days in the life of a ministry worker where only the calling of God is what keeps them doing what they're doing. I speak from experience here. Many years under my belt in ministry, if I told you how many times I had fully fixed in my mind to quit, you'd probably be shocked. Just the other day. No, I'm kidding. No. I've been there a lot in life, in ministry, because it gets tough. And again, you start to compare yourself with other people and you say, oh, Lord, I just shouldn't be doing this. But it's that calling. It's that calling that won't let you go. You stop and you think, you know what? It doesn't matter what it looks like. It doesn't matter what I feel about myself. The fact is, Lord, you called me to this. And until you uncall me, I'm going to keep doing this. Now, I know that verse 1 isn't real clear about the distinction between priests and the high priest. You'll actually be reading for quite a while before you're going to find that plainly stated, you know, in black and white. But there is that distinction between those two roles that is made in this very chapter. With just the content that we find in this chapter, it's quite clear that God is choosing Aaron to be the head of all the priests. He's choosing Aaron to be the high priest. And then he is choosing all of Aaron's sons, those present and those yet to come, future sons from his lineage, to be priests, to serve under the high priest Aaron as priest. With that said, nearly all of this chapter deals with what Aaron was to wear during tabernacle service. But there are going to be a few verses at the end of this chapter where we're going to see that distinction made and we're going to find out what the priests, not the high priest, but the priests were to wear during tabernacle service as well. They were to be much more plain, as you'll see in some photos that I have for us tonight. Now, if you're wondering, all of this priestly garb that, Lord willing, we're going to get to tonight and cover, it was to be worn during tabernacle service. These weren't street clothes. Aaron the high priest and Aaron's sons, the priests, they didn't wear these garments when they were out at the market or out working or fishing or what have you. These were for tabernacle services. These were holy garments for holy services. We're going to see that very shortly in verse 2. Unfortunately, by the time that we get to the New Testament in the life of Christ, we find out that the religious leaders had become very attached to the attire. They just fell in love with the robbery. They fell in love with how that made them feel. So they would take those priestly garments, and man, wherever they were in their priestly garb. Because when they were walking the streets in their fancy temple clothing, the people would just be wowed at them. They'd see them in their priestly garb and go, wow, now that is a holy man. What a guy. Man, walk softly, speak softly around him. And they loved that attention. They loved that elevation from the people, that praise from the people. Really what it was pride in their hearts. They fell in love with the attire and the attention that brought them. That was never what it was to be about. The attire was always to be about pictures and symbols and imagery that teach us truths about Jesus. And unfortunately, there are still people today that they wear their robes and their big old hats and all this fancy religious garb in their services. And I'm fine with that. That's fine with me. I don't care what a minister wears. If a minister wants to wear symbolic clothing to make statements about truth, that's fine. But here's where I have a problem with it. When they take that outside of the tabernacle, when they take that outside of the church, and they wear that everywhere for the purpose of getting attention to themselves. That's pride, and that's a problem, and it's their problem. The truth is, the Lord is more concerned that we understand the truths and adopt those truths into our beliefs and into our practices than he is with us wearing the garments. He'd rather us live the truths than wear the garments. It's not about the garments. But truly, there are a lot of lessons that can be learned about the attire that we're going to read about here in this chapter. They reveal truth to us about Christ through symbolism or signification. That means signs. You're going to see that word a bunch in this chapter, signet. It means this is signifying something. There's a sign behind this. There's symbolism here, and it's to teach truth. And once we learn those signs, Old Testament, then we can ditch the garb, New Testament, and just embrace the truths. Verse 2. Boy, we are in big trouble tonight. This is a two-parter, I think. Verse 2, and you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother, for glory and for beauty. And don't get the wrong idea. This is not to glorify or beautify Aaron. When Aaron is ministering in the tabernacle, the Lord just wants Aaron to be set apart. So in order to set Aaron apart and make that special designation of the role of Aaron, that's the important thing here. Not Aaron, but the role that Aaron is filling. In order to do that, the Lord orders up, he instructs for these special clothes to be made for that purpose. There is no power in the clothing. Ministry workers don't need collars and robes in order to be operating in the spirit within the tabernacle, within the church. We don't even need suits. Thank the Lord for that. Y'all know how I feel about suits. Because ultimately, this was an Old Testament thing, and the purpose isn't to make Aaron special. Again, it is to teach a truth. That truth would be this: that Aaron was to be a high priest, which is a mediator for the nation of Israel. So he's a type of Christ who Christ would ultimately become our high priest and the only mediator between us and God. Moses also serves in that line of typology because Moses, we found, was a mediator in general. Moses would mediate anything and everything. Didn't matter what it was. Religious, bring it to Moses. He would mediate it. If it was civil, you know, just daily life stuff. Hey, that person killed my ox in the field. That person stole my ox. Whatever it was, Moses would mediate all of it. He was a mediator in general. But now the Lord is zooming in the lens on one specific role, and that is Aaron as a, how do I want to say this, a religious or spiritual mediator. He is mediating that aspect of the covenant between God and his people. He is the ceremonial mediator, if you will. And I know there's a fine line there, and it's probably not something you would be stressing over, but if you needed help there, just making those distinctions, there you go. I helped you a little bit. Verse 3, so you shall speak to all who are gifted artisans, whom I have filled with the spirit of wisdom, that they may make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, to set him apart, that he may minister to me as a priest. And that is an important verse because it helps to get our thinking out of the rut when it comes to the callings and the giftings of God. Yes, the priest, that was a calling and a gifting. So is pastor in the New Testament, preacher, teacher, so on and so forth. But notice verse 3, so is artist, seamstress, and blacksmith in this chapter. The Lord considers those all to be special giftings, and God takes those giftings and he calls those people to do work for the tabernacle. So basically what this verse brings to surface and bears to mind is the truth that anything that God can use for his purposes, it can be a calling or a gifting. If you're saved, I would encourage you to take a good hard look at everything that you are even remotely capable of doing for the Lord. Everything about you, every ability that you have that you can somehow take and turn into a spiritual product, I would consider you to evaluate that and then ask the Lord to confirm callings in those areas of your life as you dedicate those giftings to the Lord, and then ask the Lord to infuse and improve those natural giftings that you have with the Holy Spirit. And that's how it works, folks. Most of the time, I find that the gifts of the Spirit that we study in the New Testament are just simply infusements of God's power in areas that we are already at least remotely gifted in. It's true, you can be somewhat okay at something, but mark my words, if you take that one something, that ability, and you begin to invest it in kingdom purposes, watch what happens. Improvement, incredible improvement. And if you're wise, you'll recognize it and you'll say, Lord, before I was using that gifting for you, man, I couldn't do it like that. I wasn't that good at it. So I recognize that spiritual gifting that you threw in there so that I could use that gifting for your glory and for your purposes. Obviously, I can't read this chapter without thinking of my Aunt Liz, because the chapter is about gifted artisans that are seamstresses that are going to sew these beautiful garments. And I think of my Aunt Liz because I believe she was truly called and gifted as a seamstress for the Lord. And she used that gifting for the glory of the Lord. And she blessed and touched our lives in this fellowship through using that calling and gifting. So although I could, I will not belabor the point and elaborate on that any further. I'd love to map this all out for you and give you a list of stuff that we don't think of as callings or giftings in the kingdom. But I can give you a list of things that if you'll just flip them around and make them spiritual, I could show you those are callings and those are giftings. I could go through each one of you. Coder. Can you code for the glory of God? Of course you can. Calling and gifting. One after another, I could do that. But I digress because we have a lot to get through and we're not moving very quickly tonight. So I'll just leave you with this thought. Make sure you do not have a limited view of the callings and the giftings of God. Verse 4. And these are the garments which they shall make: a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a skillfully woven tunic, a turban, and a sash. So shall they make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons, that he may minister to me as priest. Now, maybe you picked up on this. We're only four verses into the chapter, and already three times the Lord has made this same statement. He's used this same phrase, that he may minister to me as priest. Did you notice that? I want you to get your eyes on that phrase, because I want you to learn what that phrase is teaching us. The high priest and the priest in general, they had a primary function, and that was to serve the people. They were to minister to the people. That was one of their major roles, but it wasn't the highest and most important thing they did. The highest and most important thing they did, the Lord just told us three times, and he's going to keep telling us. The highest and most important calling or work function in their life is to minister to the Lord. And that is the highest aim for any Christian in any area of Christian service. Any Christian worker so ever, that is our aim, ministering to the Lord. Above all else, the Old Testament priest, the New Testament minister or worker, is to please and bless the Lord. It is a reminder that I constantly need, that in my study and preparation time, I can't just get stuck on what ministers to you all. I can't just get stuck on what I could say that may bless you all. I can't get completely stuck on that. I keep that in mind for sure. I keep that near the heart, of course. But my major concern in all of my preparation has to be this: what is going to bless the Lord? What is going to minister to the Lord on Sunday, on Wednesday? How can we really bless him? What can we do that's going to bring him glory and honor? What can we do that's going to build his kingdom? If we get that right, everything else is going to fall in line. That's why it's so important that we do get that right, that we aim for that, that we shoot for that in all of our Christian service. That means you too, not just me. In all that you do for the Lord, make it about people second. Make it about God first. Verse 5. They shall take the gold, blue, purple, and scarlet thread and fine linen. Does that sound familiar? Four of those five materials were used in the tabernacle hangings. That cover over the tabernacle itself, one of those coverings. The screen to get in from the outside to the outer courtyard. The screen that goes from the outer courtyard into the holy place, and even the veil that separated from between the holy place and the Holy of Holies, all made of those same four colors, those same four threads. And just briefly to buzz back through them so that you don't forget, blue symbolizes heaven, purple, royalty, scarlet, of course, blood sacrifice, and fine linen, which was actually white linen unless dyed, fine linen or white linen, which represents purity. And of course, you had the wooden framework that was overlaid in gold, right? That was a part of the construction of that inner structure as well. And so you see the gold here in verse 5. It is showing us the connection between the priest, the high priest, and the tabernacle. There's a connection there. They're to be linked. There's to be a linkage between the two. Just consider the symbolism. I already told you who Aaron symbolizes to us. No one else, nothing else, but Jesus. He's our mediator, our high priest. Aaron symbolizes Jesus to us, but we talked about this a handful of weeks ago. What does the tabernacle symbolize? That's us in the symbolism, in the typology. That's us. That's the church. We're the building of God. We're the church. We're the temple of God. We're his structure. And so when you take those two different symbolisms and consider the connectivity of both of them, when you consider the linkage of the two of them, it's quite an amazing story to tell that the Lord is connected to us. I mean, he's so high above us. We're nothing like him in that sense. We have no natural purity and righteousness, and yet he's not ashamed to be connected to us in the tabernacle. Just look at Hebrews chapter 2, verse 11. In Hebrews 2:11, the writer tells us, "For both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren." Isn't that beautiful? He's linked to us, and he's not upset about that. Wouldn't it be a shame if the Lord told us here at Anchored Fellowship, "Hey guys, you can use my name in your service as long as you're not live streaming. When you get out in public, just don't drop my name. I don't want the world to know we're affiliated. It makes me look bad." No, that's not the Lord. He's not ashamed of us. He's proud of us in that sense, to come right alongside of us and call us brother and sister. That's putting us on equal footing with him. It's incredible grace. It's incredible mercy. And the more you try to wrap your mind around it, the more it just thrills the heart with joy that the Lord would look at us like that and really honestly be fond of that linkage between us. The same material and threads run through all of it, and it's all telling us one story, isn't it? This is kind of recap, but I mean, the tabernacle building, all of those hangings, the garb of the priest already here just in the ephod. Here's what we're seeing, that same story that's being told over and over. You can just briefly look at the colors that are being presented in the tabernacle, and that gives you really a very concise, powerful, and accurate overlay of everything that God was working toward. First of all, blue. The Lord is heavenly. He's divine. He's from heaven. Purple. He's royalty. He's the king. He has full authority. White, he is pure, he is perfect, he is holy. And scarlet, he shed his blood to make that reconciliation between us and God. It's just that powerful, concise little story that the whole thing tells, the whole package, the tabernacle, the high priest, all of it just telling that same truth to us. And we need that constant confirmation, I think, because otherwise it would just seem too good to be true, wouldn't it? It's incredible. Verse 6, "And they shall make the ephod of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen, artistically worked." Verse 7, "It shall have two shoulder straps joined at its two edges, and so it shall be joined together, and the intricately woven band of the ephod, which is on it, shall be of the same workmanship, made of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen." Again, back to verse 4. There were to be six items worn by Aaron the high priest: a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a tunic, a turban, and a sash. And the Lord begins with the ephod. Now, an ephod was an apron or a vest. It was the outerwear, the outermost wear of this outfit, with only a few items that would sit on top of it externally. I'll show you a rendering real quick of this. If you could pull up that photo of the high priest. That's not it. That's not the garb you want for worship. Boy, we got some comedians back there. That's okay. I like it. It saves me from self-deprecation if someone else helps. I don't have to do so much of it myself. Okay, so that is the overall picture of what the high priest was supposed to wear. We're going to come back to this photo over and over again. I just want to point out so you know what we're looking at. The first thing we're looking at here is the ephod. It's this outer apron. It really does look like an apron. It looks like something you'd wear when you're cooking. And I guess that makes sense because, you know, there's blood sacrifice involved here. There's a lot of work involved. There's bread involved. But that's it. That's the ephod that we just read about in verses 6 7, and 8. And let's quickly keep reading here. Verse 9, then you shall take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel, 10, six of their names on one stone and six names on the other stone in order of their birth, 11. With the work of an engraver in stone, like the engravings of a signet, you shall engrave the two stones with the names of the sons of Israel. You shall set them in settings or attached frames. If you could go back to that photo real quick. I don't know if you can see this or not, but these two onyx stones are going to go on the top of the ephod. And yeah, I guess you really can't see it because it's blurry, but these stones were to set in what the Bible calls settings. They were basically just little gold frames that were attached to the ephod itself, and then those stones would sit there. What are you guys laughing at back there? Are you planning another photo, another embarrassing photo? So those onyx stones would sit in those frames, those settings, and then that was attached to the ephod. Verse 12, and you shall put the two stones on the shoulders of the ephod as memorial stones for the sons of Israel. So Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders as a memorial, 13. You shall also make settings of gold, 14. And you shall make two chains of pure gold like braided cords and fasten the braided chains to the settings. Now, if we stop right here in our reading, that leaves the chains hanging. So I'm leaving you hanging on a note here for a minute. You don't know what the chains are going to be attached to yet, but as the Lord gives the instructions, they're attached to those settings. They're attached from the stones. They're going to be attached to something. Of course, as you're going to see, it's the breastplate that's going to be on the chest over top of the ephod. So you're going to have those chains connecting the onyx stones, one on each shoulder, to the breastplate on the top of the ephod itself. Let's see, did we read all of verse 14? Yes, we did, right? Yes. Okay, so let's pull up that rendering again one more time. So just take a look at the two stones, one on each shoulder, two onyx stones, each of them having inscriptions of six of the names of the tribes of Israel, six tribes on one stone, six tribes on the other stone, that total of 12 tribes of Israel engraved in sequential birth order. That was important. It's always important to the Lord. He's always going to list these sons out in perfect order. He's going to do the same thing with the breastplate, as we're going to see. But the reason for the 12, of course, is because it pictures the whole. Those 12 tribes picture or represent the whole nation before the Lord. That's what's being depicted by those stones on the shoulders. It's the responsibility of Aaron, if you will, to bear all of the children of Israel in his religious service, in his spiritual work that he's doing. And it ought to bring to mind the parable of the lost sheep that Jesus spoke to us in Luke 15. I'll read to you three verses from Luke 15, verses 4 through 6. Jesus said, "What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost until he finds it. And when he has found it, what does he do? He lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, let's celebrate, for I have found my sheep which was lost.'" And hopefully they didn't have lamb chops during that celebration. That would just be off color. I assume they didn't. But You get the point there. It's that imagery of what a shepherd or a pastor or a priest was to do. They were to bear the sheep on their shoulders. And that's why pastors have bad backs. That's why mine's so bad, from carrying you people all day long. My uncle used to say that to me all the time when I was working with him. Never really got it until now. No. But it's that idea. That was the message for Aaron. Carry the nation spiritually. Bear them up before the Lord. And of course, it's that perfect imagery of what Jesus does for us. He bears us up in his strength. That's the meaning of the shoulders, right? That's the strongest point of the body. That's where you can do the most working and lifting and bearing with. the shoulders. If you got something on the shoulders, that's the strongest point of your body. You're using all of your body behind that. And so Jesus does that with us. He bears us in his strength, on his strong shoulders. And the truth is that when it comes to our journey to heaven, I mean actually getting ourselves there, the truth is there's never two sets of footprints in the sand. Now, that I'm not trashing that poem, Footprints. I'm just saying when it comes to actually getting ourselves to heaven, there's never two sets of footprints in the sand. There's always one. It's all his work. If we're getting to heaven, it's because we are on the Lord's shoulders and he is bearing us there. He's taking us there. He's lifting us and taking us in his strength. He's our great shepherd. He's our high priest. We don't get there on our own two feet. We don't get there in our own strength. It's him. Again, the Apostle Paul, by his grace, we're saved. And by his grace, we stand. Verse 15. You shall make the breastplate of judgment artistically woven according to the workmanship of the ephod. You shall make it of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen. You shall make it. Verse 16. It shall be doubled into a square. A span shall be its length, and a span shall be its width. Now, real quick, before we finish reading this section about the breastplate, I just want to point out that a span was the width from the tip of the thumb to the tip of the finger. That's a span. Now, I read this and I thought, no way. Someone wrote in a study that two spans equal a cubit. I thought that's impossible. It didn't seem right to be, because do you remember what a cubit is? It's the distance from the tip of the elbow to the tip of the middle finger. And I thought, there's no way two of those equal one of those. But it's true. If you do it, you'll see. Two spans, a perfect cubit. You can try that yourself. If it doesn't work out for you, something weird about you. Something didn't work out in your maturity process. But for most people, it works. Two spans is a cubit. If you could go back to that photo real quick. I want to point out what we just read. That breastplate that we're now studying, and I know it's grainy, but as we just read, it was to be made of... It was to be a span wide and a span high. So it's a square, and it's going to have the stones on there. We'll talk about that in a minute. But that was to be made into a pouch. We just read it. I don't know if you caught it. It was to be doubled in length and then folded up. It was to be made into a pouch. Now, what do you suppose the high priest put in that pouch? What do you suppose the high priest kept in that pouch? Sermon notes? Anointing oil? His iPad? Well, hold that thought. We'll come back to it and see what he put in that pouch. Verse 17. And you shall put settings of stones in it, four rows of stones. The first row shall be a sardius, that's a red stone, a topaz, that's a lime green, and an emerald, that's a proper green stone. This shall be the first row. So three stones in the first row. And we're going to have, three columns in the first row, and we're going to have four rows. Verse 18, the second row shall be of turquoise, which would be what color? Turquoise, not a trick question. A sapphire, that's a blue stone, and a diamond, which would be clear. Verse 19, the third row, a jacinth, which is another blue stone, or perhaps an amber color. Some of these stones have multiple colors, so we're not real sure what they went with. Verse 19, the third row, a jacinth, an agate, and that could be just about any color. I mean, an agate can be just about any color, which, by the way, those are beautiful stones. Go look those up later. Agates are beautiful. And an amethyst, and that's purple. Verse 20, that's the second row, the third row. And the fourth row, a beryl, or barrel, I'm not sure how you say that and not sound like a hick. Beryl, which is a sea green, an onyx, which is extremely similar to the agate stone. It can be just about any other color. Really, the only difference between the agate and the onyx is the layer bands in them. One is parallel. One, the bands are parallel. Well, you guys don't care about that. You can look up stones on your own time. But The Bible goes on to say, and a jasper, which is like a crystal. It's clear. Not meant to be a pun or a joke, just stating a fact. And then the Bible says, they shall be set in gold settings. Verse 21, and the stones shall have the names of the sons of Israel, 12, according to their names, like the engravings of a signet, each one with its own name. They shall be according to the 12 tribes. So those were the 12 stones that were to be set into the breastplate. And I don't know if you remember this or not, but not long ago, I referenced the first stone and the last stone in the breastplate. Do you remember that reference? What were we studying? We were studying Revelation. If you don't remember that reference, I'm sorry, I do not have time to go into it tonight, but it's a very important order and sequence that we see repeated over again, time and again in the scriptures. In fact, when we get to Revelation chapter 21, I believe it is, Revelation 21, when we begin studying about the New Jerusalem that descends out of heaven and touches down to earth, we're going to read that that New Jerusalem is made up, it's constructed of these same stones. So we're going to come back to this, and I'll save that for our Revelation study. Just real quick, throw that photo up one more time just to make sure you see it. 12 stones, 3 in each row, 3, 6, 9, 12. And in each of these stones, in perfect birth order, in sequential birth order, the names of each of the 12 sons, the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel. Verse 22, you shall make chains for the breastplate at the end, like braided cords of pure gold. 23, and you shall make two rings of gold for the breastplate and put the two rings on the two ends of the breastplate. 24, then you shall put two braided chains of gold in the two rings which are on the ends of the breastplate. Now I'm going to speed through this a little bit because it's talking about how everything is connected, and I don't want to bore you with all of those minor details or that minutia. Again, every time we come to a chapter like this, what I'm going to do is I'm going to hit the high notes. I'm going to give you the major truths. I'm going to point you in the right direction and turn you loose to study until your hearts are glutted from what you're studying here. There's tons here. It is very deep, and we don't have the time to go into it all tonight, but we'll hit the important parts for sure. So these two braided chains you shall fasten to the two settings. Again, remember, that's those frames that those two onyx stones sit on top of the ephod, and put them on the shoulder straps of the ephod in the front. Verse 26, you shall make two rings of gold and put them on the two ends of the breastplate on the edge of it, which is on the inner side of the ephod. 27, and two other rings of gold you shall make and put them on the two shoulder straps underneath the ephod toward its front, right at the seam above the intricately woven band of the ephod. Verse 28, they shall bind the breastplate by means of its rings to the rings of the ephod using a blue cord, so that it is above the intricately woven band of the ephod, and so that the breastplate does not come loose from the ephod. Verse 29, so Aaron shall bear the names of the sons of Israel on the breastplate of judgment over his heart when he goes into the holy place as a memorial before the Lord continually. Now, put verse 12, what we already studied in verse 12, together with verse 29, and it reveals a principle for ministry and a truth about our Savior. In verse 12, as we covered, Aaron was to bear the names of the people. He was to bear the nation symbolically on his shoulders. And in verse 29, Aaron was to bear the names of the people over his heart. It tells a very full story, I believe. In ministry, we are to serve in order to lift people up, and we are to do that with people in our hearts. And as far as the Lord is concerned in this picture, we find a wonderful truth about the Lord. Number one, we covered it. He bears us up in his strength. But here's the second part of it. Verse 29, we are near and dear to his heart. That's where we sit in relation to the Lord. He has us, his people, at his heart. Verse 30, and you shall put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord So Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. Now, was anyone curious about the very curious name of the breastplate? It's called the breastplate of judgment. Sounds horrifying, doesn't it? It's not. It sounds horrifying only if we are somehow mistaken about judgment and always assume that judgment is horrifying. But it's not. Judgment is horrifying if it's the wicked that's being judged. But if it's the righteous that's in relationship with the Lord, judgment's not a bad thing. Judgment is a wonderful thing. But pocket all of that anyway, because that's not what we're dealing with when it comes to the breastplate. We're not talking about heaven and hell kind of judgment. That's not the symbolism or imagery that we're studying in the breastplate. We're studying the breastplate as an article that would be used in judgment calls, in decision making. In other words, the breastplate God designed from the beginning to be used in order to decipher the will of the Lord. And back to the pocket, the breastplate. Remember, it was folded, it was doubled over, it was folded so that it formed a pocket. What goes in the pocket? We read it. The Urim and the Thummim. Or the Urim and the Thummim, technically, in Hebrew, because they're plural words. Those two words mean lights and perfections. And no one is really sure how these were used, the Urim and the Thummim. No one really knows how they worked, regardless of what they tell you, because there's just nothing, at least authoritative, that is written, either inside or outside the Bible, that tells us how these two things, the Urim and the Thummim, were used. All that we know is that they were used to decipher the Lord's will. They were used. Moses and Joshua used them. Saul, King Saul, remember him? He tried to use these to decipher God's will. The only problem is by the time he tried to use these, he was not on speaking terms with the Lord. So the Lord didn't answer him through the Urim and the Thummim. Lights and perfection. Here's the idea of the two Hebrew words. It's telling us this. This is the way, this is the method to find perfect light on any given subject, on any given decision, on any given topic. Most people guess that the Urim and the Thummim was a white stone and a black stone. That's confusing to me because they are Hebrew plural words, so I'm kind of skeptical about that. But if that's the case, if it was a white stone and a black stone that was held in the breastplate itself, the pocket underneath the breastplate, their thinking is that you would ask the Lord a question, you would consult the priest, he would consult the breastplate, the Urim and the Thummim, and they would draw one of the stones, and if you got a white stone, that meant, hey, go for it. And if you got a black stone, that meant, stay away. You know, white stone, positive. Black stone, negative. And that would sort of connect with what we were studying in the letters to the seven churches, where the Lord offered one group, one church, a white stone, right? That is very similar to casting lots. It's pretty much the same thing. Casting lots was a thing that at one point the Bible actually encouraged and approved and authorized. That's not the word I'm looking for either. Condoned, confirmed, approved. I'm not sure what word I'm looking for, but it was an okay thing. The book of Proverbs tells us in Proverbs 16, verse 33, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. And many times, you might be surprised how many times in the Old Testament people resort to the casting of lots to find God's will. You take those two stones, and whatever one comes up, that's the Lord's answer. Proverbs says, hey, that's a valid thing. You pray, you tell the Lord what you're asking, what you're trying to decide between, and then you cast the lots, and the Lord will dictate the response, his response, through the casting of those lots. Valid thing. Then we get to the New Testament. When's the last time that lots were used? Acts chapter 1. An unmitigated disaster. You're in the New Testament era now. You're in the New Covenant. And there's Simon Peter leading the charge on this, as usual. And he thought to himself, we're down one man. We're one man down. We did have 12 disciples. There were going to be 12 apostles. But Judas, he's hung up. And we need another guy. So we got to have a 12th guy, Peter says. And so what Peter decides to do is use this ancient, early method of deciphering God's will. He tries to use the casting of lots in order to decipher who God wants for this 12th man, the 12th apostle. And I love how Peter does it. He says, Lord, this is in my own wording. Lord, we want your will on this. We want to know who you want right now, Lord. The decision needs to be made right now. So we want to know who you want as the 12th guy. Here's your options. Matthias and Barabbas. Joseph, surnamed Barabbas, who was also called Justice, something like that. The guy had like three names. Didn't matter because he didn't win. He got the black stone, I guess. And Matthias got the white stone, so Matthias was chosen. But here's the problem with that, and we're going to have to end on this. I guess we'll just pick up there next week and continue on, get a little more in-depth than what I planned with the chapter. But here's the problem with that. It was an early, outdated way of deciphering God's will for a person's life or for the nation. It was a real thing at one point, but this whole thing has been progressive. The Lord's been shaping it and moving it from the beginning. Many things about our relationship with the Lord changed from those early days. In those early days, oh man, watch your step around the Lord. Don't get too close. He'll strike you down for doing the wrong thing. We get to the New Testament, it's, hey, come on in into the presence of God. Experience His glory for yourself. Well, the same is true for deciphering God's will. And I know it's a big topic. It's something we're all very much interested in. How do I discover God's will for my life? How do I figure out God's will for each and every decision that I have in my life? And it could be tempting to have a little bag of two rocks, right? The black stone and the white stone, and say, okay, Lord, Walmart or Target? Blackstone, Walmart. It would be tempting to do that. It would be tempting for every decision we're making or every direction of God's will that we're aiming at to have some sort of visible thing like this, you know, to be able to say, Lord, if you want me to be a pastor, let the sunset be red tonight. Beautiful red sunset. And so the Lord gives you that sunset and it's red. And you don't really want to be a pastor. So you say, well, it's more amber, Lord. It's on the fence about that one. Lord, I was meaning deep red. This isn't a deep red. So, well, it's decided. It's confirmed. The Lord doesn't want me going into the pastorate. And so we do that. We play those games because that method is very subjective. That method is vague. And the Lord does something much different for us. And it amazes me, even when I find myself wishing, oh, I just wish I had a bag of rocks to say, Lord, which one is it? But what the Lord did is so much better than that. He gave us in the New Testament, in the New Covenant, He gave us the Holy Spirit in us. How crazy is it of us to go back to putting out our fleeces before the Lord? How crazy is it for us to roll the dice, and if it's a 7, or, well, I guess there's not a 7 on a dice. Roll the dice, and if it's a 4 or a 6 or whatever, then that's the Lord's way of saying go for it. How crazy is it for us to move toward these vague methods of finding guidance when the guide is in us? It's like driving to a destination and getting out the old map that's got like 10 folds in it, and you're driving and you're opening this thing up and you're trying to find your own way with the map. When you could just get your phone out and put the GPS on and let the map itself talk to you and tell you, left turn, dummy, right turn, dummy. How much better is that? So the Holy Spirit in us, that's God's New Testament solution for finding His will. I know it can be frustrating because it has to come through prayer. That's tough. We have to pray. We have to invest. But isn't that easy too? If we'll just pray? If we'll just go to the Lord and seek Him and then watch the Lord. Just, Just pray, Lord, here's my decision. I'm going to pray about it until I know what your will is. And then just watch the Lord. Wait on the Lord. Observe life. See what directions the Lord is pointing you into. The Lord told us this method of guidance was coming in the Old Testament from the beginning. He said he was going to put his spirit in us. And that his spirit in us would say when to turn to the left hand and when to turn to the right hand. His spirit internally would guide us. Folks, we have so much more in the way of God's guidance today than they had back there with the Urim and the Thummim, whatever it was, and the casting of lots and the breastplate to decipher God's will. All you have to do is go to the Lord and pray and listen to him speak into your heart and watch the signs as he points you constantly. That song that comes on and confirms it. That word from the preacher that comes and confirms it. Well, keep those things in mind. We'll pick up right here next week. Verse 31 will be our next verse. And we'll finish out the chapter and see what the Lord has to say about the rest of Aaron's attire and the attire of the priest. Would you stand?